welcome to the Good Librations podcast. I'm Carla.
And I'm Lauren.
Good Librations is basically the two of us discussing literary topics and genres at length. If you love storytelling in all its forms, you're in the right place.
A quick monthly reminder to leave us feedback, either via the Kiama Library website or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Today's topic is... Stories Across Time!
We've been running into this topic accidentally for some time now, so today we're actually going to discuss it. But first, Shelf Absorbed. I've been reading After the Forest by Kel Woods. So I just loved this gorgeous dark fairy tale. It's a delicious follow-on from the Hansel and Gretel story with flavours of Snow White and Rose Red. The world is vast, grounded in true history, but guided by magic as Greta negotiates life after the forest. It's super rich, really compelling reading. The forest is as much of a character, I think, in the story as anyone else is, and wolves and bears and foxes sort of weave through the undergrowth of the forest. End of the story, really.
Good. Well done.
And there's a chapter in it titled Gingerstruck, which... Mm-hmm. I mean, like, great,
yeah.
But also, like, that's a bit how I felt about the story. Oh. You know, like, I was just ginger-struck by it, like, very drawn into it.
Love that.
Yeah, give me all of the gingerbread and the not-poisonous apple pie, please, this Christmas.
It does have a very sort of warm Christmas feel about it, too, doesn't
Actually,
it?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Maybe it's the gingerbread.
Yes, absolutely.
I've been reading... A Court of Wings and Ruin, which is the third book in the very good A Court of Thorns and Roses series. I'm enjoying it, but honestly, I don't know how it will top or even equal the second book of the series, which was A Court of Mist and Fury. If you know, you know. Book Talk has very fully embraced this series, and more specifically the three main male characters of the second book and beyond. So I feel quite mired in it, really. Like, I'm listening to the audiobook when I drive to work, and I'm listening to the audiobook when I drive home, and I'm listening to the audiobook as I wander around making dinner, and then I read the book before, you know, like, it's sort of taking up all of my life and time. It's everywhere. Yes. And delightfully so. Hard recommend. It's fantastic. And,
exactly.
The description alone of the space, like her world building, yeah, is just...
It's beautiful.
Like, second to none, really.
Yeah, and those boys, they're they're pretty nice.
The bad boys, yes.
And honestly, Wings and Ruin is as good as Mist and Fury, I think.
Look, I'm about two-thirds of the way into it now, and yes.
Yeah, I think it measures up.
Oh, it's a big ask.
Cause, no, but just wait.
Because
Yeah, I'm finished.
It is very good.
Yes.
It's very compelling. And now onto Shelf Important, where we discuss the topic of the day.
So we first started talking about this topic in episode 4. Can you believe it?
Yeah.
So that was our fairy tales episode. And I really think that's the episode where we kind of settled into the groove of the podcast maybe and just found our comfort level.
Sure.
Yeah. And so there was a quote I mentioned in that episode, the great mass of infinitely various narrative passed on and disseminated through the world by word of mouth, remade again and again by every person who tells them.
Mm.
Great quote.
Great quote.
Then we talked in episodes 7 and 8, our episodes on myth and legend, further about this idea that these threads of story weaving together, they build on themselves over time. And you said you can pick up any Mills and Boone novel from any point in their publication history and it will follow the exact formulaic plot devices set out in medieval romances.
Yeah. So they started... Mills and Boone started being published in like 1917, around the First World War. But they're the same. It's the same story as medieval romances. That's and they're right. The same story now. And this
Exactly. I'm thrilled to see all of the Hallmark Christmas movies.
Which are the same story.
Start to appear. That's right.
They are chivalric stories.
That's
they
right.
1000% are.
We had almost a live chat.
Yeah.
All watching the same movie, the three of us, the other night.
Yeah, that's so true.
It was very, it made it better.
It made it so much
it
better.
It made it better. Yeah. It was so fun. And then we talked about love stories in episode 11. So that was the start of our second season. And it was all about sort of every love story essentially having the same structure and themes and tropes. It's familiar,
yeah,
whichever one you're diving into.
So many academics, most notably author Christopher Booker. Great name for what he does, really.
Absolutely.
Christopher, he believes that there are only seven basic narrative plots in all of storytelling. So different settings, characters, and conflicts, but essentially the same. So those seven types of stories are overcoming the monster, rags to riches, the quest, voyage and return, rebirth, comedy, and tragedy.
Yeah, it's such a strange thing because it feels a little bit reductive in some ways, but it's not untrue. You know, like we've discovered that accidentally over the course of the podcast, but like you see it written down and you're like, well, yeah.
Yeah, no, I totally understand what you mean. Like it feels narrow, like we're kind of hemmed into a particular story or particular tropes, and we don't really want it to be that. But actually, I kind of think it's the opposite. Like I think it democratizes stories in a way, like it makes them accessible to anyone, not just as members of an audience per se, but also as creators. It's like the day you realize literally everything is made up. It's also the day you realize, hey, like I can make stuff up.
I can be
part of that process.
Yeah.
And the amazing and terrible freedom of that is kind of great and kind of overwhelming.
It's
the same thing.
Yeah, sure. So we've compiled a list of stories that fit into these categories with examples of the ways that they've sort of been told and retold over time.
So the first one is Overcoming the Monster. The Overcoming the Monster plot is a story arc that follows a protagonist who struggles to defeat an adversary. So it can be literal, like Frankenstein, or a more internal conflict stemming from things like fear, illness, or addiction. Examples of this type of story are Beowulf, Jaws, Jurassic Park, any of those kind of monster movies, really, The Thing.
Yes, sure.
You know?
Yeah.
It's very much a hero versus foe story. There's a thing to be overcome and the hero overcomes it. Sometimes, of course, the writer subverts this and the hero doesn't overcome it, or the overcoming leaves the hero in a worse position than maybe they were before.
Uh-huh.
But typically
it follows.
Yeah.
Yes.
Typically there is overcoming to be done and yes. So a great illustration for this type of plot that has been told and retold in so many forms that it's overwhelming is The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde by Robert Louis Stevenson. This was published in 1886 and is about a mild-mannered doctor called Henry Jekyll.
Mm.
And we'll put a spoiler warning here. But honestly, if you haven't read it yet and have also managed to dodge 137 years of any mention of, like, literary's most notorious plot twist, please skip ahead.
Sure. Yeah, so, like, if you haven't read it, you still know it, don't you?
Exactly.
Surely.
I haven't read it. You haven't read it.
No.
No, we know what happens, yeah. Right?
Absolutely.
So the reader is introduced to Mr. Edward Hyde as the antagonist, not knowing at that point that he is, in fact, the same man. Gasp! Throughout the story, the reader discovers that Jekyll secretly developed a potion to allow him to separate the good and evil aspects of his personality, meaning that he could change back and forth between Jekyll and Hyde. Of course, this all goes terribly wrong, which I'm absolutely shocked about.
Shocked.
He becomes Hyde permanently, but dies. So the overcoming of this particular monster is fairly bleak, but it's also fairly indicative of that bleak time in literary history.
Yeah, that's true.
Because I feel like the last half of the 1800s gave us some of the bleakest stories that ever bleaked. Yeah. Think about it. Anna Karenina, Dracula, Tess of the D'Urbervilles, Sybil, Mary Barton, even Bleak House. Like, it's in the title.
I know, all of that, isn't it? It's all just...
It's really just bleak.
Awful.
What was going on? There are so many retellings and reimagining of this story particularly, including Mr. Hidey Ho by Veronica Parker Johns.
How great is that title? Mr. Hidey Ho.
1956. Things slightly less bleak in 1956.
Yeah, that's right.
So they felt like they could muck about.
Add some levity to this terrible story.
Right. The Strange Case of Miss Jekyll and Mrs. Hyde by Emma Tennant in 1989. Dr. Jekyll, Orthodontist by Dan Greenberg, 1997. The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen by Alan Moore, 2000, also a movie, including the characters Captain Nemo from Jules Verne's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and the Invisible Man from H.G. Wells' book of the same name. Mina Harker also shows up. Dorian Gray also shows up, which everyone hated this movie. Everyone hated it. I love it.
I love it.
Same.
It's a great film.
I love it so much.
It's so good. Yes. And Sean Connery?
Sean Connery is amazing.
I still remember.
Who's he? Alan Quatermain.
He's Alan Quatermain.
Yeah.
I still remember that line, and it's so dumb because I quote it and no one knows what the heck I'm talking about because they don't know the movie. But and he goes, and the game is on. And I love it so much. It's such a fun film.
Honestly, everyone needs to give it another go and calm down. It's supposed to be a bit silly.
It's supposed to be bananas.
Yeah,
yeah.
And also Jekyll and Hyde, the musical, by Leslie Bricusse in 1990. So Jekyll and Hyde seem to pop up regularly in both Dracula and Sherlock Holmes retellings as well, and as part of an extended series like Wishbone and Goosebumps.
Mm-hmm.
And you could say that any kind of evil doppelganger mm-hmm. kind of movie, a kind of story, is closely connected to Jekyll and Hyde. And I don't really think it's hard to drill down why this story has such cross-generational appeal. Like, we all struggle with the darker halves of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really interesting take on that kind of psychological awareness that we are not always our best selves.
Sure.
You know, like, sometimes we are hangry.
Regularly.
every day. And sometimes we are selfish or hateful. Yeah. And sometimes we are cranky and snappy. And sometimes we terrorise Victorian London as a huge and grotesque monster version of ourselves until we murder a vicar. You know, stuff we all do.
Super relatable. Okay, so the second type of story is rags to riches. So this plot is where the main character begins in a situation of poverty and disadvantage and goes through a positive change in fortune. So in wealth or class or beauty, influence, respect, and they generally have a happy ending.
Yeah.
So we're just, the first one's really bleak. This one's a happy one. Examples of this type of story are The Prince and the Pauper, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, A Little Princess. So it's a tale of sort of unjust oppression juxtaposed with triumphant reward. So an illustration of this type of plot, retold a zillion times, is Cinderella.
Oh, lovely Cinderella.
Mm.
Cinderella.
So again, if you're the only person in the history of time to like not know the story of Cinderella, just prepare to be enlightened, please.
Oh, gird yourselves if you don't know it.
The Cinderella theme may have originated in classical antiquity with the tale of a Greco-Egyptian girl, Rhodopis, who washes her clothes in the stream. An eagle takes her rose-gilded sandal and drops it at the feet of the pharaoh, and he gets all the women to try it on to find out who fits. So there's a bunch of other versions through time across so many different countries, but the version that we know today was first written in 1634 by Giambattista Basile.
You did that so well.
Oh, thanks. Sometimes things work. But then it was popularised in 1697 by Charles Perrault, which introduced the pumpkin, the fairy godmother, the glass slippers. So the story goes, a man's lovely first wife passes away, and for the sake of his daughter, he marries another woman. She is the very definition of the wicked stepmother, and her two daughters are equally horrid. Yeah. In some versions, the father dies. In others, he's very much sort of under the stepmother's thumb, or he travels a lot and is quite absent. The stepmother and her daughters make Cinderella do all the housework, and the ash from the fire inspires her nickname. The prince invites all the ladies in the land to a ball, from which Cinderella is barred from attending by her stepmother, but of course the fairy godmother appears to her and makes a coach from a pumpkin, animals into attendants, and her outfit into something fit for a princess.
The dream, the literal dream.
Yes. The prince is, of course, entranced by her, but then the spell fails at midnight, as it is wont to do, causing Cinderella to run from the ball, leaving the glass slipper behind. The prince tries the shoe on all the ladies of the land, and despite the stepmother's efforts, of course, he finds Cinderella and he marries her.
Thank God. What else would she have done?
Just swept the half forever.
Forevermore.
Retellings of the story include Cinder by Marissa Meyer, in 2012. So a series that also includes Red Riding Hood, Rapunzel and Snow White. And it's very good. Highly recommend that one.
Highly recommend. Amazing series.
Yep. Into the Woods, the musical by Stephen Sondheim in 1988. Also, bunch of fairy tale characters in that. Highly recommend. Yeah. Ella Enchanted by Gail Carson Levine, 1997. Also a movie of the same name. Ash and Bramble by Sarah Prineas, 2015. And Geekerella by Ashley Poston, 2017. So we all love that rags to riches story, don't we?
Yep.
I love it. And just for interest's sake, we had a look into how realistic a story it really is. Like, what are the odds that someone born into rags will actually become rich? Based on a 2006 study by economist Tom Hertz, if one is born poor, the likelihood of that person becoming rich, speaking purely in economic terms, is less than 1%. And yet, when the New York Times did a poll asking people whether it was possible to start out poor and become wealthy, over 80% of respondents said they believed it was.
It's because we all grew up in Cinderella.
Yes.
We all thought there would genuinely be a point at, like, where mice were helping us get dressed.
It's true.
And that we would marry a prince.
Do you know what? I actually know people that have this mindset, in a way, where they think that there's a quick and easy way for them to make lots and lots of money.
No.
Right. They just have this mindset of, like, if I only sort of set these few things up, the dominoes will fall and everything will go perfectly forever.
It's so wild to me.
It's so wild.
Nothing is set up that way.
No.
Like every bit of evidence to the contrary.
Yeah.
Tells us that that is not.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen. We also did a little quick research into how likely one is to marry a handsome prince and become a princess.
Just in case you wanted to know.
So someone on Reddit did the actual calculation, and of course, because, like, math, bleh.
Yeah.
The chance of a single woman from anywhere in the world marrying one of the approximately 50 available princes that exist at any given point is exactly, like, 0.000057%. So
I think that it goes without saying that there's a chance.
Well, I mean, Princess Mary.
That's right. We all cite Princess Mary. Oh, there's a lot of pressure under that lady.
Oh, absolutely.
And look, since we wrote this, I've been thinking about it a lot.
She's been thinking about it a lot.
I've been here
like a lot.
So much.
Just this particular section.
Yeah. Because there's something kind of unsettling about this theme for me, and I was trying to drill down why. I think we can agree that mostly the protagonists of Rags to Riches story all embody a very particular type of morality. They are often very kind, they are very selfless, they are very generous, and interestingly, their plight or their suffering for them is not because they are poor per se, but rather because they are being exploited or abused or otherwise taken advantage of by a very visible villain.
Sure.
They don't ever really say explicitly, this is happening because I'm poor.
Yeah,
I'm thinking that mainly fairy tales here, but I think this is sort of common throughout the genre.
Mm. And also, often the person in this moment too is quite resigned.
Oh, for sure.
Like, and okay with it, almost.
Sure,
like, yeah. They're sort of like, well, this is my lot.
Yeah, no, I can think of a few different, stories that contrast that, like, The Pursuit of Happiness and things like that.
Sure.
They kind of contrast that. Like,
yes.
They're sort of in aid of bettering their situation.
Absolutely.
But yes, mainly because they're so humble. It's the nature of their own sort of humble heart.
Yeah.
That they're just like, well, womp, 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 you know.
But I shall carry on in the face of
exactly,
all of this. Yeah.
I am so resilient. Because I think that in pursuing wealth for wealth's sake, it kind of undermines that very specific characterization that is built very consciously so that we cheer for them when they win.
Mm.
Because if they were like, well, this sucks, but it's cool because I'm going to be rich soon and I'm going to do this and this and this, you know, like,
yeah, we don't invest in them. Eh. Yeah. We don't care now.
I don't really want to watch you get dressed by mice. You know? So, like, yay, they have riches and a castle and servants and they totally deserve it because they were nice to mice and fawns and people even poorer than they were.
Yes, you know? Right, sure.
They've earned
it.
That's right, yeah. Exactly, by being humble
and
happy to be poor. So the dissonance for me comes in here. The story goes that the poor protagonist suffers, does not hold wealth, and as a result, often does not hold power. Those two things come hand in hand. Ultimately, by the end of the story, they are rewarded with both. Now, in reality, individual wealth only exists because of exploitation. It only exists because of exploitation. It's like at some point in the accumulation of wealth, usually one person or an entity gets wealthy due to both the exploitation of another or the hoarding of resources so that ultimately someone goes without.
That's true.
That's the only reason that individual wealth exists.
Yes.
So the whole genre reads so ironically to me because even after they have the wealth and the power, we still root for them, right?
Mm.
Like, even though it sits so dissonantly with everything that we've been told about how wealth works in their world, like, why aren't we asking, like, Mia Thermopolis, for example, to melt down all the candlesticks in the castle in Genovia so that some proletariat can buy some bread?
Yeah,
you know, sure. Like, the structure of the system that exploited them remains the same.
Yeah.
We are just being tasked with being okay with it because now the girl with the zany hair is the one benefiting from
it. Sure, yes.
Right?
Yep.
So, yeah.
Very true.
So many thoughts about this and feelings, clearly. Another idea struck me when musing on this genre was the metaphysical rags to riches story. So the transformation of a character who is perhaps miserable or ruthless
right.
or exploitative themselves,
yeah.
going through some emotional crisis, who as a result of some catalytic factor, usually involving an orphan or three ghosts. Right.
Yeah.
Or the disabled. Comes to the realization that they are indeed rich. Rich in life or love. And they need not want of material wealth. I don't know why I...
Talk like Dickens.
Talk like Dickens. Yeah, that's it. Sometimes this story is being presented as a kind of an antidote to pursuing wealth. The messaging behind it being that we should be grateful for what we already have, which I mean, yay.
Mm.
But this also doesn't ever really challenge that same system. It just asks the characters and by extension the audience to be okay with how we exist within it.
Yeah, right.
And I think both can be true, you know. I think we can all hold hands around the Christmas table and be in love with love, but then also placard up and storm the gates, you know.
Do you know what? That's like your whole personality.
Yeah, that's it.
That right is there. The two halves of you, Carla. And I love you for it.
Yeah, so I had some frustrations with Rags to Riches.
Yeah.
And some feelings and some thoughts, but yeah.
Love that.
So the third story is The Quest. Probably one of my personal favourites.
Sure.
You get a lot of adventure stories in this category, and some of which also fit into the next category of Voyage and Return, and also could be called the Hero's Journey as well. So the quest plot is where the protagonist... So the quest plot is where the protagonist of the story goes off on a journey to reach a tangible objective, a place, an object, a person, or some kind of knowledge, or to throw a ring in a volcano.
Sure.
Lots of obstacles to overcome, etc., etc. So examples of this kind of story are, of course, Lord of the Rings. Moby Dick. Around the World in 80 Days. So the quest in those examples is, of course, throwing the eponymous ring into the fires of Mount Doom, finding and taking revenge on the Great White Whale, and the completion of an 80-day journey that will win the protagonist a bet and secure their reputation. An illustration of this type of plot is Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson, making his second appearance today. Old Robert Louis.
Yes.
It was published in serialised form from October 1881 to January 1882 under the title The Sea Cook or Treasure Island, and then in book form from 1883. And this is the classic pirate story where Jim Hawkins helps his parents run an inn in England. Billy Bones stays at the inn, revealing he is a pirate and has a treasure map. He fears that other pirates will come for the map, which absolutely happens because Billy Bones has a big fat mouth on him. And Billy Bones dies because he has a big fat mouth. Who just wanders into an inn, right? And is like,
I am a pirate.
I have a treasure map.
Oh my god.
Dear. Anyway, Jim and his mother flee from the pirates with Billy Bones' money and the map, fooled into hiring shipmates that are actually Long John Silver and his crew. Mutiny, treachery, sword fights and murder, oh my.
Yes.
All of the ingredients for a great quest story.
Mm-hmm.
Retellings, of which there are many. Treasure Island, Runaway Gold by Jewel Parker Rhodes, which is 2023. That's brand spanking. The Adventures of Long John Silver by Dennis Judd, 1977. The Little Friend by Donna Tartt, 2002.
Mm-hmm.
Pieces of Eight by John Drake, 2009. Treasure Planet, the Disney movie that sends the story into space. And we've talked a lot about the quest, and I think that we're both all about the quest.
Really. Absolutely.
Like, it features a lot in what we read.
Definitely.
And I read a great quote by Kristen Lamb where she said, "The thing about the quest is that most people long for it. It's wired into the construct of what it means to be human. Maybe we aren't daring enough to set out on our own adventure, but we love to experience adventure all the same."
Yeah.
Like, I think most of us aren't going to be traversing lands and saving the world in any literal sense.
Yeah.
But I also think they are absolutely analogies for more realistic, more human quests we all kind of go on. So yeah, the more mundane relationships, jobs, tasks, and the wider kind of ethical quests or more even existential quests.
Yeah.
You know, like our relationship to social justice, how we interact with the environment, what our role is in the larger global space. One of the stories and movies I really love for this message is The Secret Life of Walter Mitty.
Great film.
Great film.
That surprised me so much because, like, I mean, Ben Stiller is a bit hit or miss. Like, I sometimes love and sometimes hate.
I think before he did this, it was all a very specific kind of comedy.
Yes. Yes, you're right. It was a real departure for him.
Yeah.
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 And it's delightful.
And it's a beautiful representation of the quest and the hero's journey and voyage and return, but also just a sort of really lovely representation of the fact that we all have it in us.
Sure. Yeah.
We all sort of have it in us to do the thing.
To do the thing.
Yeah.
I love that. So the fourth type of story is Voyage and Return, which is, again, a little bit of crossover from the quest here. But this one is all about the journey rather than the thing that you get at the end. So there's sort of like a lot of unknown lands, the unfamiliar, the barely imagined, the people met, the things learned, having your perception of the world changed. So examples of this type of story are The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, and Castaway.
Like, I heard this thing somewhere where you're either a Wonderful Wizard of Oz person or an Alice's Adventures in Wonderland person.
What do you mean, one or the other? What are you talking about?
I feel like I don't know. It's like you're either a Beatles or a Rolling Stones person.
I mean,
like, I feel like it's kind of that kind of thing.
I get it to a point. I feel like, as an adult, I love them equally, but probably in my younger years, I was a Wonderland gal.
Yeah, I think I'm a Wonderland gal. I was a Wonderland. Still am.
Yeah.
Something about Alice and the whole thing. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah.
Love it.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
So these stories also work very well as metaphors and allegories for contrasting cultures, prejudices, and stigmas in our own world. So the illustration that we've chosen for this, because we can't have a podcast without it, is The Odyssey. And I think, like, I wanted to put this in this category because, yes, it's a quest, but the quest is the return.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You
get back.
Yeah. Like, that's the whole point
of
Odysseus getting back to his wife Penelope. So many of the retellings focus more on the quest part of the journey, but I think it's just the perfect example of the voyage and return. It was written as an epic poem in 24 books by the ancient Greek poet Homer somewhere around 725 to 675 BC.
What an overachiever Homer was, right?
24 books of an epic poem.
Right?
Far out, man.
Not a lot to do. Ancient Greece.
I love that. It's non-linear, throwing the reader into the middle of the tale, learning about the events through Odysseus's sort of telling of his story. Penelope is beset with suitors as she and her son Telemachus await the return of Odysseus for the siege of Troy. Odysseus gets stuck in all sorts of places on his unfortunate travels. He's held captive by the nymph Calypso. He shipwrecks on the shore of Scheria, encounters the Lotus Eaters, the sorceress Circe, escapes a Cyclops, navigates encounters with Scylla and Charybdis. And when he does get home, he reveals himself to his son first before developing a plan to dispose of Penelope's 100 plus suitors, which he does. He kills them all.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, not sorry.
What? What is going on with Penelope, though?
I know. I know.
What is it about Penelope?
That's 100 too many suitors.
Right? Like 100 dudes just rocking up going, so Penelope, hey, what happened? Like, why? But like, I feel like those ancient Greek stories went really hard on,
sure.
You know, like Helen of Troy.
Oh,
as well,
yeah, she was another one. Yeah. Just unrealistic, really.
It's like super unrealistic. Super unrealistic. Like, I feel like it's the, it's sort of the catalyst story of putting women on pedestals.
Yes. Yes.
That they don't deserve nor want. We don't want them. Yeah. We don't want to be up there.
Leave me alone, please. Oh, my goodness. Retellings of this one, Cold Mountain by Charles Frazier, 1997, and then the 2003 movie of the same name. O Brother, Where Art Thou? In 2000. Finding Nemo, 2003. Circe by Madeline Miller, 2018. Great book. And the SpongeBob SquarePants movie, 2004.
Yeah. There was no way we were going to get through an episode without referencing the Odyssey.
Yeah.
Everything is the Odyssey. And the Odyssey is everything.
Yes.
So our next story is Rebirth. Rebirth stories are often found in religious and creation myths, but this type of story is simply a dramatic transformation on the main character. This change is instigated often by events beyond the protagonist's control and leads to self-awareness with growth from the flawed starting point to the positive endpoint. So examples of this type of story are A Christmas Carol, Beauty and the Beast, The Lion King.
Yeah, so it's like you were saying before about the Christmas, like A Christmas Carol kind of tying into the, was it the Rags to Riches one?
Yeah, sort of a metaphysical Rags to Riches.
Yeah, that's right. And so it's so funny how you can find those parallels like across story types.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And of course it can be physical as well, like the aforementioned Beauty and the Beast, but usually the internal change is the profound one.
Mm-hmm.
The perfect illustration for this type of story is Pygmalion.
Pygmalion.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
This was a play in five acts written by George Bernard Shaw and first performed in England in 1914. This story could also fall into the comedy category as it is also very funny.
More parallels.
More parallels.
More
I think there's a. I think it's like Venn diagrams.
Yeah, sure. That makes sense. I like that.
Henry Higgins, a phonetician, accepts a bet that by changing the speech of a Cockney flower seller, he will be able in 6 months to pass her off as a duchess.
Yeah.
Eliza Doolittle, said flower seller, undergoes a grueling training and Higgins manages to deliver on the bet as she is accepted into high society. He washes his hands of her and Eliza is left feeling like she doesn't fit into any class anymore. And in future versions, there is usually a romantic realization between Henry and Eliza. Is that really how it ends?
Yeah.
Like, there's not, they don't actually get together in the original.
Not in the original,
play.
No.
George Bernard Shaw, who hurt you?
Well, it's so nice when it happens.
Yeah.
Like, the musical's gorgeous. Oh, that was the next thing you were going to mention.
My Fair Lady.
Sorry, I jumped ahead.
Well, yeah, the musical My Fair Lady is one of the retellings and the subsequent film version of the same name.
I saw Anthony Warlow in the lead as Henry Higgins in that, and it was so delightful.
Another one is She's All That.
Love that.
Pretty Woman, of course. Although she wasn't actually accepted into that society by the end. Like, there was still that stigma around her that she technically wasn't accepted, but he accepted her. Like, he decided to sort of shuck off.
She was in the running for... You're talking about She's All That?
I'm talking about Pretty Woman.
Oh, right. Woman. I see. Yeah.
Yeah, because she was a sex worker, I think that the stigma of that still...
Sure.
Was the still quite present.
The acceptance came from him, not from the broader...
Correct.
Yeah, sure.
Ruby Sparks and Selfie.
Have you seen Selfie?
I haven't seen Selfie.
It's so good. It's a TV show. But it ended after one season and I'm so sad.
Oh, no.
It was John Cho and Karen Gillan.
Love John Cho.
Love John Cho.
Yeah. This is another story that we all love, you know. I'm going to go out on a maybe not very long limb, though, and say that the Rebirth story kind of got co-opted there for a stretch of time.
Mm-hmm.
To make women, quote, beautiful and acceptable to a very specific kind of beauty and behaviour.
Yeah.
Okay. And this is my issue. This is my, I take umbrage.
Like it became like a makeover story.
1,000%.
Not a rebirth, yeah.
And I know nobody asked, but I'm going to illustrate why it annoyed me with one very specific example. Okay? It's very niche. Alison Reynolds and the worst makeover in cinematic history.
Okay. So this is the Breakfast Club for people who don't know.
So when we meet Alison, she is a very odd little, fantastic little, grungy little weirdo who happens to be stuck in detention with four other Shermer High School teenagers on a chilly Chicago Saturday in March 1984.
Just setting the scene.
Set the scene. Things happen, the teens bond, and then she has a terrible, horrible, no good makeover. And when we all watched it in the 80s, we kind of went, ooh, ah, doesn't she look pretty? And now Emilio Estevez can love her, ooh, ah. And now, as a 42-year-old reclaiming my gremlin roots, I really think she was just done a huge disservice. And if Emilio Estevez couldn't see that she was a literal goddess in her oversized black jumper and her giant bag of bonkers secrets, then he never really deserved her.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't love me at my throwing of the bologna, Alison, then you don't deserve me at my headband with the flower on it, Alison.
Yeah, but you know what, too? Mm. Like, it's one of those makeovers that's not a real makeover.
No, she just literally took a black jumper off and put a headband on.
Correct.
Yeah.
And doesn't look better. Like, actually exactly. Looks great.
That's why it's before terrible. That.
Yes.
That's why it's awful.
Nonsense.
But what it did was, is it played to this very specific kind of beauty that society at the time, and probably still now, was saying, hey, this is the standard that you all need to set. You need to be fresh-faced and clean and
the princess
and young
sort
and,
of
yeah, exactly.
Pink lip gloss, exactly. Sparkly standard, yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
You know, her oversized black jumper and her fringe down to her nose was just not the thing. But it hurts my heart. But also, I love The Christmas Carol, and I will watch every iteration of it forever. I'll watch the Muppets one, and I'll watch the terrible Jim Carrey thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, I love it.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. The sixth story type is comedy. So in literary terms, a comedy story is rich in irony where the readers or audience know more about what's going on than the characters do. So there's obviously humour, with characters usually making grand gestures and mistakes, but generally with a happy ending in store. So examples of this type of story are The Importance of Being Earnest, anything Monty Python, sure. And then you've got like the rom-com side of things like Love Actually. So I read that Shakespeare's plays were broadly divided into comedies and tragedies for the following reason. So if nobody died, it was considered a comedy, for example, As You Like It. And if everybody went on a murder spree, then it was a tragedy, e.g. Macbeth. I wanted to use A Midsummer Night's Dream as the illustration for this type of story. I love all of the layers at play in it and how everybody is trying to trick everybody else, but there's a lovely ending, despite everyone's, you know, best efforts not to be. 'Tis obviously by the great bard himself, William Shakespeare. And it was published in 1600.
I know, bonkers.
Bonkers. So in the story, Theseus is about to marry Hippolyta. Hermia and Lysander, in love, seek refuge in the forest when Hermia's father demands she marry Demetrius. So there's, like, you can already see, mm-hmm. just, there's going to be lots of mistaken identity.
Well, because there's about 75,000 cast members in this particular play. How anyone wrangled them all in 1600, I do not know.
That's right. And just keeps track of who's who.
Yep.
So then Helena likes Demetrius, so she tells him where they went and she follows. And then Oberon, king of the fairies, has a fight with his queen Titania and tells his servant Puck to drop magic juice into her eyes as she sleeps. So he wants her to fall hopelessly in love with whoever she sees when she wakes. He tells Puck to drop the juice into Demetrius's eyes also. Puck accidentally puts it into Lysander's. Lysander wakes up and falls in love with Helena. It just goes on and on and on. There are, like, rivalries. There's, at the same time, a group of artisans are rehearsing for the wedding. One of them gets a donkey's head, and Titania ends up falling in love with him. It's just so much confusion and misunderstanding and general tomfoolery. Everything is restored to rights. Everyone is married who should be married. And then the troupe performs a parody of all of these events at the wedding. It's like nonsense, madness, greatness.
But do you know what? I hate it.
Do too. I love it because it's crazy.
No, I hate it. I hate farce. Like, I cannot stand farce. I find, I just, there's nothing more frustrating to me. And it feels like, and I know it's very clever. And I it's understand clever. That.
Like, that's why I like it, academically,
I can understand the cleverness of it. Like, the Pink Pantherness of it, you know.
Sure, sure, sure.
I very much understand the genius of Peter Sellers and all of that. And the, yep, genius, yep, yep. the genius of this. But the entire time I'm watching it, I want to die. Because it's just so frustrating that I know something that they don't know, and if they just communicate.
Yeah, you, but you have that thing, don't you, where you hate thing. Miscommunication in stories because, as a plot device.
Because it seems just like such a... It's just such a weak plot device. And I know here it isn't. It's sure. used very
it's differently. It's deliberate in this case, yeah.
But it's so frustrating, and I hate it.
Retellings of this story include Midsummer's Mayhem by Rajani LaRocca, Love in Idleness by Amanda Craig, Foolish Hearts by Emma Mills, Wondrous Strange by Leslie Livingston, and A Midsummer Tempest by Poole Anderson, which also brings in another of Shakespeare's plays, The Tempest.
Mm. Mm. Also, 10 Things I Hate About You is The Tempest.
Right.
No, Taming of the Shrew.
Taming of the Shrew, you're right.
Taming of the Shrew.
Yes, correct.
Sorry, Shakespeare. Jeez.
But then also, She's the Man is Twelfth Night.
Correct.
Like, I love all that.
Viola. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Sorry. Love that. Keep going.
And also, Clueless is Emma.
Yes. Not Shakespeare. Not Shakespeare. But
sorry.
Classic.
Yeah. Classic. Love but just, Clueless. I love how they did it.
And yes.
It was just, like, really subversive. Even with She's the Man and 10 Things I Hate About You, there was a spate of them.
Yes.
In the 90s. And that's the, right. In the early 2000s. And I love how they very, very, it was like guerrilla style Shakespeare and guerrilla style classics. Yes. Because everybody was watching these going, this is a fantastic story. Oh my God. And yeah. You're like, yeah, that's right.
It's been you're told before. Shakespeare. We're going to trick you into watching Shakespeare.
That's right. So the next story is tragedy. In direct opposition, obviously, to comedy, tragedy exposes humanity's weaknesses and their destructive potential. Here's where you see an overabundance of character flaws, greed, pride, anger, all leading to downfall. They can be quite compelling in their power as cautionary tales.
Mm-hmm.
Examples of this type of story are Othello, Oedipus Rex, also ick,
yep.
The Great Gatsby.
Yeah.
As well. That's a very famous one.
But there's something about tragedies, right? They just sort of slaughter you, but they're a more digestible form maybe of the tragedy of life. And so, like, they're important for that reason. Like, you can kind of process something in that form that maybe is hard to process in actual
Yeah. fact. I mean, I've never been a Danish king. Or a Danish prince, rather.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you know, like, there's something – that was Shakespeare's genius, is that he took these very big stories and made them beautiful but also made them sort of relatable.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
An obvious illustration for this type of story, and we're sticking with Shakespeare today, is Romeo and Juliet.
Yes.
Now, we've talked about this many, many times. We do not think it is a love story.
It's absolutely a tragedy.
It is a love story. The story is as compelling as it is bananas.
Yeah.
We've said it before and we'll say it again. The characters are 13 to 16 years old. Everything takes place over 3 days, and the most tragic events occur because of a breakdown in communication.
Yes. Carla's pet peeve.
Yeah. The story goes that there is a... Again. Spoiler. The story goes that there is a vendetta between the families of Montague and Capulet in Verona. Masked Montagues crash a Capulet party, and it is here that Romeo Montague falls immediately and irrevocably in love with Juliet Capulet. Do you think? He absolutely meant to make that rhyme.
Oh, yeah.
Because
yeah,
the whole thing is like rhyming couplets almost.
Do you know what I thought you were going to say then?
Yeah.
Is, oh, do you believe in love at first sight?
That is a big question. I feel like that's a whole other podcast.
Yeah, it's true.
Do I believe in love at first sight? I find it. No, I believe in lust at first sight.
Sure. And a connection at first sight maybe, sure, but definitely. Like love, like yeah. that is bananas to me. And it's so weird in that play how instantaneous.
Yeah.
They meet and that is it.
But they're 13.
Yeah,
Their literal occipital lobes have not connected to their amygdalas. Like, they do not have.
It's true, and I suppose it's that thing too of like being fairly up until this point, maybe not so much Romeo, but definitely Juliet sort of being quite sheltered.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it's like this and then first
Leonardo through the fish tank.
I mean, you know. Sure. Sorry. I digress. That's
fine. Yeah. So it's here that Romeo falls immediately and irrevocably in love with Juliet Capulet, who is engaged to someone else, big city suit guy, probably.
Mm-hmm.
The two somehow arrange to be secretly married the next day.
This is what I mean.
But Romeo's attempt to halt a street fight, because sure,
yeah,
leads to the death of his best friend, Mercutio. And in his anger, he kills Juliet's cousin, Tybalt. Romeo is banished. Juliet fakes her own death in the hopes that she can then be with Romeo because, sure. The message explaining this fails to reach Romeo in time, and believing her dead, Romeo then kills himself. And Juliet wakes to find Romeo dead and kills herself.
Right.
Because, sure.
That miscommunication thing. I know. It's
the worst.
It's so frustrating in that case because you're literally seconds.
Yeah.
If you had just waited, you dope.
But also, I hate it, but also the power of that, right?
Yes.
Like the power of knowing, because we know the story, we've seen it a million times, but the power of knowing and willing every single time.
Yes.
Every single time that she's just going to wake up just seconds earlier.
I know.
Or he's just going to, like, I don't know, take a CPR class and actually realize she's not dead. Do you know, like, every single time you have that hope.
And I know.
Like, the absolute power of that. Every single time. I have the same thing when I watch Titanic and I think, surely Jack this time will get on the door. Right? It's the same thing. And I know how it ends.
And I suppose the power in it in this situation is that it's for the families, isn't it? And they realize how, like, absolutely stupid their feud, their vendetta is. Yeah. And they're like, whoops.
Yeah.
But also now your kids are dead.
Yeah, right.
Like, you idiots.
And also, you know, spoilers. But honestly, if you don't know how this ends at this point, I have a whole other bone to pick with you. So, retellings of Romeo and Juliet. The Tragical History of Romeus and Juliet by Arthur Brooke in 1562, which is actually the poem Shakespeare based his play on. So, less of a retelling and more of an inspiration,
mm-hmm.
aka Shakespeare just ripped it off.
Sure. Like, very blatantly.
Really blatantly. Didn't even change the names.
No.
West Side Story musical, obviously, by Leonard Bernstein and Stephen Sondheim, and the resulting movies,
mm-hmm.
Love. Never again in my life will I ever see a group of people coming towards me clicking and not know what that's from.
Absolutely.
Right. Rosaline, which is a movie in from 2022, referencing Romeo's ex-girlfriend,
mm-hmm.
and including Romeo and Juliet as secondary characters, which I love that because,
yeah,
you know,
it's
poor fair Rosaline.
Yes.
Ronnet and Jameel by Pamela L. Laskin in 2017, and These Violent Delights by Chloe Gong in 2020. Lots of them. There's many, many more.
Oh,
many more.
Yeah.
Because we love it. We love Romeo and Juliet because the world thinks it's a love story and it's not.
So we found a few quotes about the idea of plots that we thought we would share for I Can't Help Myself. So this one from Mark Twain, there is no such thing as a new idea. It is impossible. We simply take a lot of old ideas and put them into a sort of mental kaleidoscope. We give them a turn and they make new and curious combinations.
Spot on, Mark.
Yeah, well done.
Mark, see, again, it's that name. It should not belong to history. It should belong to, you know,
I forget what episode you said that in.
Can't remember. Very early on. And this from John Dryden, England's very first poet laureate, who at some point in the 1660s said, plots, true or false, are necessary things to raise up commonwealths and ruin kings.
Love that. Very love poetic. It. Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
Poet laureate.
Yeah.
Even.
It's fancy that. American crime writer Jim Thompson said this, there is only one plot. Things are not what they seem.
And it's very true. I really love that quote because it's like, if everything's what they seem, the story's
there's,
over.
There's no story. Exactly. It's so true.
And Ray Bradbury of Fahrenheit 451 said, remember, Plots are no more than footprints left in the snow after your characters have run by on their way to incredible destinations.
I love that.
Great.
And I love that idea too, that characters just have a life of their own. Like, yes. And a lot of writers say that, do that, don't yes. they? That like they start writing their way into something and then their characters will just do something that they never planned
it's
for.
It's very true. They take you to a place and you might not like that place or have ever wanted to go there, but that's where you are.
That's it. And finally, Barbara Kingsolver said, plot comes first. The plot is the architecture of your novel. You wouldn't build a house without a plan. If I wrote without a plot, it would just be a pile of bricks. Characters are your servants and they must serve the plot.
And Barbara Kingsolver coming out of left field there with a little bit of a contentious take, because yeah. I think you'll find if you poll writers,
yeah.
some absolutely adhere to this kind of yes. philosophy, but some would be like, no, just sort of...
Yeah, yeah.
Make it up as I go along.
Well, they call them plotters and pantsers.
Plotters and pantsers.
Like flying that's by right. the seat of your pants.
Yeah.
And a lot of writers, Alison Tate included,
yeah.
writes her way through that first draft without really knowing where it will go.
Meredith Jaffe, I think, plotter.
Uh-huh, yes.
So, yeah, very interesting. Very it interesting. Is. And I don't really know. Like, I think I'm more of a fly by the seat of your pants because I want to see where my characters take me.
Sure.
But also I would benefit from a plot.
Sure. I think I like plan. I'm about a half-half.
Sure.
I like to have some kind of idea, but then also there are things that will crop up.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Thanks for joining us today. Don't forget to follow Kiama Library on social media and check out the podcast page of our website for links to everything we spoke about today. And if you have time, please rate and review wherever you can.
Our next topic is going to be story songs.
Looking forward to that one.
Yes, this is all you, babe.
Yeah.
Thanks for sticking with us. See you next time.
Bye.